So the previous year when I taught, gave this introduction to Buddhism in TCV 2 years ago, I think, so Ajahn Yongzin's study of mind, which is in versified form, written by Ajahn Yongzin, I actually memorized it when I was around 10 years of age. And when you recite it, the kids is on the different too, I could also recall many of the lines, but some I could not. So it's important to know that's the working of our mind, because in the world today, if we look at the world, there is lots of killing amongst human beings due to some discrimination on the basis of different colors and so forth. And so because of disturbance of mind, these misfortunes happen in the world. Of course, drugs and alcohol can perhaps help you to overcome these mental problems temporarily, but they are not permanent solutions. So because of our jealousy and competitive sense of competition, I mean, they disturb our peace of mind. And so the peace of mind is disturbed not from outside, but this happens because of your mind being undisciplined, uncontrolled. And therefore, you need to find the means to overcome this disturbance of the peace of mind from within and not seek some solution, external solution, like doctors or other things. So because of this unruly mind, undisciplined, uncontrolled mind that we have, people are even killing each other. And then there is a huge gap between the rich and the poor. And the poor are so poor that they don't even get three meals a day. And but many people remain rather indifferent to this situation of others. And then there is a caste system where people are discriminated on the basis of their caste. And this is also very unfortunate. And people remain very poor as well due to this discrimination. And therefore, we are lacking in the means to deal with the problem in our mind. And therefore, we have lots of problem in the world. And therefore, in order to solve this problem in the different problems in the world, what we need to do is we need to develop a calm mind, disciplined mind. And the greater it develops, the lesser the unruly states of mind will be. They are like the cold and hot. When there is cold, and if you actually create a fire or some heat around you, then you'll feel warm. And as the warmth or the heat increases, then the coldness decreases. So similarly, this is the same principle of this opposition to the cold by fire. It can be applied to the mind. And so the mind, different states of mind have different ways of apprehending their objects. And therefore, there are those states of mind which oppose each other in relation to their object of apprehension. And therefore, these can be, this understanding can be used to counter the undisciplined states of mind. And for that, we need to know what is the disciplined state of mind, what are the different types of mind which are disciplined, and what are their causes and conditions and which bring about them, and how to cultivate them. And therefore, it is very important to learn about the working of our mind. So, of course, people of religion say do pray for peace of mind and disciplined mind and so forth, but mere prayer will not help us. So even in the case of Buddhism, Buddha himself has said that he cannot remove the suffering of sentient beings with his hands, nor can he wash away the sins of sentient beings with water. In that, if so, then how does a Buddha help sentient beings? He teaches what are the different undisciplined states of mind and what are the disciplined states of mind, which are the disciplined states of mind are those states of mind whereby you have cleansed your mind of the undisciplining aspects, unruly aspects, and therefore you should increase through cultivate those disciplined states of mind and increase them within yourself. And his Buddha says that he cannot shift his own realization into others, but only by giving teaching, by showing the reality or the truth that the Buddha helps beings to on the path to liberation. And therefore, we need to understand the different types of mind. And we also heard during this recitation by the students that there are different states of mind, and our main mind is accompanied by its mental states, different mental states, cetasikas, and and therefore, we need to learn what actually brings about these different states of mind, the disciplined states of mind. So when you talk about spirituality, of course, studying about mind or the knowledge of mind, is taught in our scriptures, but we cannot leave it with confine it to religion as such. And I usually refer to the Indian, classical Indian knowledge, which are to be used in secular life as well, not leaving them only to religion. So if we are able to create a peaceful individual, then that will help also to have a peaceful and family and community and nation, and then the global citizens. And so I usually talk about promoting the study of mind, which is found in the ancient Indian wisdom tradition. And so from my own experience, I've been telling this to people when I talk about the different types of mind and mental factors, the scientists, even with whom I have discussions, find it really helpful. And so, of course, if you ask me for details, the precise definitions and so forth, I may be stuck. But because I have studied these different types of mind, different aspects of mind and mental factors and so forth, I could share quite a bit with them. And these must be used as intellectual subjects and academic subjects and not just religious. So why I am trying to talk about having the introduction these kind of wisdom from India in school systems is because in the future we will have the younger generation running the world, and there will be perhaps if people become more disciplined and controlled and peaceful, I mean there will be a better chance of peace, more peaceful and non-violent world as a whole. And so with regards to psychology, it is very, very rich in the ancient Indian traditional wisdom tradition, because there is the in this tradition the practice of meditation, of the single-pointed concentration, and insight meditation, which is analytical meditation. And therefore there is lots of explanation of the working of mind. So when you develop this single-pointed concentration, there's also explanation of on how to develop it with the help of mindfulness and introspection, and also with regard to vipassana, the penetrative insight. There is also the explanation of vipassana in relation to the three realms of existence. Considering the lower realm, such as the desire realm, to be gross in comparison with the form and formless realms and so forth. And so it is found in all the Indian traditions and within Buddhism as well, in the Pali tradition as well as the Sanskrit tradition. So since we have the tradition of studying classical texts, from the past, I mean, we need to really pay more attention to it. For more than 1,000 years, we, the Tibetans, have kept this tradition of studying the classic texts, the major classic texts of India. Generally, in the past, people have considered the study of these texts to be the job of the monks and nuns, and common people do not pay much attention to studying them. Of course, the 6 million Tibetan people have great devotion and faith in the teaching of the Buddha. And even today, while we are undergoing so much hardship, the spirit of Tibetans inside Tibet are still remain very strong. And in such a situation, we need still more effort in studying, and there should be more people who are able to explain this, the different states of mind. It would be good. So as I said before, when I was a child, I memorized this text and also the versified text on the reason and logic. I have memorized them since when I was a child, but as time passed by, days and months and years passed by, of course, at the feet of my tutors, Yongzhen Ling Rinpoche and so forth, I memorized them, and I feel very close to these texts, and therefore, because I feel close to these texts on mind and study of mind and awareness, I told the students to memorize it. And then there is also the Yongzhen Tagrik, the Tagrik or the study of marks and reasonings, which I memorized, which was written by Yongzhen Pobuchok, Chamba Jatsu. And so I memorized the person, but the teaching, and within the teaching, not on the words, but the meaning, and within the word, the meaning, the definitive and is what is relied on, and not the provisional ones. And within the definitive teachings, not just intellectual understanding is relied on, but deeper insight into the teaching. They are going through the four types of principles in logic, or which are the So today's discourse is mainly focused on the students. We have started this program for young students to introduce, to give an introduction to Buddhism. So today there are from 20 different colleges, 107 in Delhi, 20 colleges, 107 students from Bangalore, 10 colleges, 100, and Chennai colleges, 29 students, and so forth. So in total, there are students from 70 different colleges, 528 students from 70 different colleges in India, or universities and colleges. And also students from United States, four, from Netherlands, one, and 90 plus students from higher institutions in and around Dharamsala. And then from Masjid Homes, 1,500 students in total from the different schools. And then there are participants here from the Buddhism Introduction Committee or organization in Dharamsala. So, male and female students, I would like to greet you all. First of all, and then from Thailand, there is a group of monks with their abbot, and they are going to do a peace march. Last year also they did it. And so you are the custodians of or followers of the Pali tradition of Buddha's teaching. So in terms of the development of the chronological order of followers of Buddhism, first there were the Pali followers of the Pali tradition, and then later the Sanskrit tradition also spread. So the Pali tradition followers who also followed Theravada tradition are you are the senior students of the Buddha. Therefore, I pay my respect to you. Thank you. And today, those who presented the debates, you really showed your proficiency in debate. So it's not just that you actually memorized the text and then just regurgitated them out here, but you really exhibited your proficiency in the art of debate. So when I was studying as a kid, I really had memorized the text and then had to repeat them when I was doing my practice in debate. So sometimes I may get to the point of finishing what I have to say, without having much to say. So with regards to learning the path of reasoning, of course, it comes to us from the Buddhist panditas of the past, the scholars of the past, but it helps us to do analysis of the reality of things. So this path of reasoning or logic could be, although it comes from Buddhist texts to us, it could be used for different subjects as well. And so if you could do that, it would be very beneficial. From my own experience, having met many scholars and people from different religious traditions and other scholars, and also scientists, for over 30 years I have interacted with them. So I meet such people, many such people, and during those meetings, when I have discussions with them, because of the study of logic and reasoning that I have done, it really helps me. Therefore, some scientists, because of being at, coming to appreciate this, the procedure of debate, have asked me if this could be used in other subjects, in learning other subjects as well. And so some, few scientists have asked me this. So this is very special, they say, the way you do your analysis and investigation and examination of things. Just as the Buddha has said, analyze my teaching thoroughly. Oh, monks and scholars, analyze just as a goldsmith tests the purity of gold by rubbing, cutting, and burning, and so forth, likewise, you should check my teaching and then accept it, not out of your devotion to me. And therefore, it seems it's going to be really helpful in the world, in the future as well, to use this kind of investigative measure. So because of our ignorance, and what happens is we create problems. So therefore we have to use reasoning to come to the conclusion that things do not have any independent objective existence, because by grasping at true independent existence of things, we create a lot of problems. And therefore this is the way to go about with using logic, as the Buddha himself has said, that we should not follow him just because he says so. And then within the teaching, there are those of the provisional and definitive teachings of the Buddha. And therefore, in order to differentiate between these two, we cannot resort only to scriptural authority, because then there will be no end to scriptural authority. There are many different teachings the Buddha has given, but we need, therefore, to use reason. And therefore, the Buddha has actually told us that we should not just take his words without doing any analysis. And when we do analysis into his teaching, we can find that the teachings are not consistent. And therefore, to combat this the grasping at true existence, we need to use reasoning and find and actually point to this grasping at true existence, that the way you apprehend and hold on to things is not the way things exist. And when you are able to do that, when you are able to feel convinced, bring conviction within yourself that things do not have and do not exist the way this grasping grasps at, then you will be able to reduce its intensity. And then with regards to cherishing others over oneself, it's not only to be believed on the basis of some scripture. Of course, texts like Ratnavali and so forth teach about these, but mainly in the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara by Shantideva, it actually uses reasoning to counter our self-grasping attitude, the self-cherishing attitude. So even scientists say that if you are compassionate and loving, then you will have better physical health and more peaceful you will be. So if you are constantly overcome with, I mean, if you anger and anxiety and fear because of this selfish motive, thinking yourself about yourself alone, thinking that, oh, if I did this, I may lose something and so forth, and you may be apprehensive what would happen to you, and therefore there's anxiety and there's anger and so forth when some provocation happens to you. Whereas if you are able to counter this self-cherishing attitude through multiple reasons as given in Bodhisattva Charyavatara, and then you when you familiarize yourself with those reasonings and the conviction that you gain through them, then you will see how you can actually combat this self-cherishing attitude. And therefore, to transform these two states of mind, or aspects of mind, grasping at true existence and self-cherishing attitude, is not through some faith in the teaching, but through reasoning. And you'll be able to transform yourself. So this is from my own experience, someone who has reached 82 years of age now. And from my own experience, I can tell that these reasoning and logic are very important. So, of course, there are tens of thousands of people who are studying classic texts. But this study has not spread amongst the general public. It has remained amongst the few scholars in the monastic institutions who are, I mean, these scholars are comparable to those of the Nalanda masters who are called the Six Ornaments and Two Sublime Teachers. And therefore, I have found it very important for the general public to have the study of logic and also the classic texts. And then to the nuns as well, I have found it important for them to do these studies of these logic and philosophy. And therefore, last year, just as I have urged them to do to study philosophy through logic, the nuns have done that. And then, as a result of their hard work, last year they received the Geshema degree. So, reductio ad absurdum logic and then syllogisms are used in Buddhist study. For thousands of years, we have been using them. And now there are people amongst Chinese and also those English-speaking people and so forth. There are people who are paying attention to learning this. Of course, in Sanskrit, there we have the text, but the Sanskrit is more or less a scholarly language these days. So with regard to using logic where you say it follows that, and then also it is so because so-and-so is amongst the Tibetans the most prevalent. So there are Tibetan masters like Sakya Pandita and so forth who have written text on logic and epistemology. So today, if we have to find the language which is best for using this kind of logic in a study of philosophy, it is only the Tibetan language. So in this language, we have in the Kanjur the translated words of the Buddha, over 100 volumes, and then the exegetical treatises written by Indian masters, over 220 volumes. So we have kept these alive for over 1,000 years. So this is amazing. So our past forebears and our were really intelligent people. So whether Tibetan script was devised newly during Songtsen Gampo's time or it was improved over what already existed, the Tibetan script that we use is based on an Indian script, and the ancient Indian script. So the Buddha statue in the Lhasa Cathedral, Jokang, was brought from China. So when I visited China in 1954 and when I and then came back to Tibet, returned to Tibet in 1955, on my way back, I stopped in Xinyan, the ancient Chinese capital. So I was shown an empty seat in a shrine room, which was which I was told was the seat of the Buddha statue in the Jokang Cathedral in Lhasa. So it had come from there. So although in all the familial relation was already established between Tibetan kings and the Chinese kings since the 7th century. When it came to actually learning and bringing Buddhism to Tibet, the Tibetan kings looked towards India to take Buddhism from India directly, despite the familial relation with Chinese emperor. So Master Shandarakshita was invited in the 8th century, and he was himself a follower of the Madhyamaka philosophical philosophy. And within this school of philosophy, there are the divisions into those who accepted external existence or the lack of an external existence. And then Shandarakshita was someone who followed the tradition which rejects any external existence of phenomena. So he was the follower of the Madhyamaka philosophy, which also aligns with the Yogacara philosophy, which means the Vijnanavada philosophy of rejecting any external existence. And so he was the founder of this Yogacara Savatantrika Madhyamaka philosophy school. So it's not just a historical history, but we can actually see his writings, such as the Madhyamaka Alankara, the ornament of the middle way. And then Master Shandarakshita was a great logician as well. So with regards to logic and epistemology, he has written this. Dignaga was wrote Pramana Samuchaya, and it is also a terse text. And then the verse of salutation of Dignaga's Pramana Samuchaya says the Buddha was someone who became a reliable person and so forth, which verse was actually explicated, and the meaning of it was explicated by Dhammakirti in his second chapter of Pramana Vrittika. And then Chandrakshita also wrote the text called Tatov Samgraha. And so after Dharmakirti's Pramana Vrittika, the commentary on the valid cognition, then Shandarakshita wrote his Tatov Samgraha, where you find that he actually deals with, of course, Dharmakirti deals with those Indian non-Buddhist logicians and argues against them. And who have gone before him. And then after that, when Chandrakshita came, there had been also other non-Buddhist scholars who have criticized Dharmakirti's position and come up with other ideas. And those were also dealt with in Tadav Samgraha. So after the Dignaga and Dharmakirti wrote their text, there had been other questions and cons raised by non-Buddhist traditions and others, and therefore Chandrakshita deals with them as well. And so we can, I mean, the text he wrote, we can actually read it, and therefore from this we can tell that he was such a great scholar. So it's not just a story that is told to us, like a legend, but it is something which is which we can actually see. So if Chandrakshita had not been to Tibet, perhaps we would have just remained a ritualistic kind of Buddhist. But because of him coming to Tibet, we have actually been introduced to using this human, marvelous human brain to investigate into the nature of things and the teachings of the Buddha and so forth. And therefore, we can actually see how great our ancestors were following this kind of tradition established by Chandrakshita. They only had pa, the Tibetan dough balls made from purged, roasted perch. Parched barley. And so we need to feel proud finding this to be the case, that we don't need to feel totally depressed. So in this, after 1959, when we came into exile in the 60s and 70s, then there were Tibetan young Tibetans who actually felt ashamed to say they were Tibetans. But since we have this marvelous tradition, which was taken, paid attention by intellectuals and scientists in the West, then those who were ashamed to say they were Tibetans in the past, changed their attitude, and even non-Tibetans have begun to say there are Tibetans today. So people from Nepal and so forth who are not Tibetans have begun to say they are Tibetans. And in the past, the Buddhist tradition in Tibet was regarded as Lamaism, as if it's not a true teaching of the Buddha. And particularly in connection with the tantric tradition that we follow, people have started calling our tradition Lamaism because the general public have not a deep understanding of the teaching of the Buddha. But then the monasteries more or less focused on doing ritual dance and making dharma offerings and so forth. So these Westerners who visited Tibet in the past found them quite attractive and funny sometimes, and they called the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism Lamaism. And then great masters and lamas from the different Tibetan traditions of Buddhism, such as the previous Karmapa Rinpoche, and Dunjom Rinpoche from the Nyingma tradition, and other masters of all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions have left a great legacy for the Tibetan Buddhist tradition to shine forth in the world. And then many scholars also became teachers in college and universities. And then people also in the West and so forth took interest in the tradition that we have. And then I have been emphasizing that this Buddhist tradition that we Tibetans have is the true in the lineage of the true lineage of Nalanda monastic tradition. So we memorize the classic texts, the root texts, and then we study these root texts on the basis of commentaries and sub-commentaries and so forth, and thoroughly check the teaching through study and by using logic. And therefore, I have emphasized that Tibetan Buddhist tradition is in the spirit of Nalanda tradition. And accordingly, although we already had the tradition of praying to the eight masters of the Nalanda tradition, referred to as the six ornaments and two superior or sublime masters. On top of these eight, I added nine more, and then made a praise to them, wrote a praise to them, making up the 17 Nalanda masters, praise to the 17 Nalanda masters. So today, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that we follow is the pure Nalanda tradition. So of course, our forebears have were disastrous in terms of politics. So we should just leave that aside. But with regard to the spiritual or religious tradition that we have, the great classic texts written by the 17 Nalanda masters are in our own language. We don't have to resort to any other language like Sanskrit. We have these in our own language, and this is a pride of us as our nation. So therefore, you should protect and preserve it. The elder generation is now finishing. So I make this division into the 20th century and 21st century generations of people. So the 20th century people belonging to the generation of 20th century are now coming to an end. And I am part of this. But I am physically, I also am healthy, and I also have a very so when I talk, I have a silver tongue as well. And so, because I have this skill, I usually tell people one of my weaknesses is that once I open my mouth and start talking, I go on blah, blah, blah. So this is something that we should be proud of as Tibetans, this Nalanda tradition. So because I have been emphasizing the Tibetan tradition is a Nalanda tradition, today it is a tradition which can have discussions and dialogues with scientists through reason and logic. For example, in the case of quantum physics, so within Buddhism, we have the philosophical assertions of Chittamatra and Madhyamaka. So, of course, in quantum physics, they say that things do not have any objective existence. As long as there is an observer, they say, there is an observed object. So when it comes to talk about the observer, the scientists do not have much explanation here. But in Buddhism, as long as there is an observer, for example, a subjective mind, like an eye consciousness, which sees an object, a blue color, for example. In Chittamatra philosophy, they say that the perception of blue and the blue, which is the object, are simultaneous or arise simultaneously. And then from the point of view of Madhyamaka, it is said that just as what the Chittamatras say, that things do not have any objective existence, likewise, the inner subjective mind which sees the objects also do not have any independent existence. And so we can, in a way, make up for what is lacking in the quantum physics about regarding the observer. And then, we can see the profundity of the tradition that we have, which follows both logic and reasoning and philosophical understanding of things. And then when it comes to psychology, what the scientists are explaining seems are quite rough or coarse understanding of the mind. In the past, of course, the classical science explained mind on the basis of the brain waves and so forth. But towards the end of the 20th century, the scientists, neuroscientists, are saying that there is a third factor which actually can impact the neurons and the fine particles of the brain. So, whether they call it mind or not, they say such a thing. And then when they investigate or check people who in meditation, people who have done many years of meditation, their brains are found to be functioning differently, or they find something different. So when someone is doing, for example, a single-pointed concentration and other meditations, they find that these meditations are actually impacting the brain as well. And therefore, they talk about apart from the brain, there is some third agent. And then in the Tibetan community, we have something called the phenomenon of Thugdam. So when someone is staying in Thugdam, it means that the person is clinically dead because of the flow of blood having stopped into the brain, and there's brain death. And so for a few weeks, people still, even after clinical death, the body still remains very fresh. And so this is a fact, and there must be some explanation to this. And so some scientists have begun to do some research on this phenomenon of Thugdam. And therefore, with regard to psychology, when you go deeper into the explanation of mind, the tradition that we have of explaining and describing the function of working of mind can actually support. There's no other way than finding support from this. And then with regard to study of logic and reasoning, although there are many countries following the teaching of the Buddha, it is only the Tibetans who have followed the study of logic and reasoning by following the writings of Master Dignaga, Dharmakirti, and so forth. So I feel that if we say that these are taught in Buddhism, we are narrowing the scope, perhaps. But although they come from Buddhist literature, these subjects can be actually learned or studied by all people. So with regards to, for example, psychology, we have a psychology which is shared with non-Buddhist traditions and also philosophical tradition. There are many different points ideas and concepts which are parallel or shared with the non-Buddhist traditions, except maybe when it comes to talking about self or Atman and so forth, which are rejected in Buddhism. So in India, there was the tradition of the philosophy and also logic and epistemology. So with regard to the Four Noble Truths, in learning about philosophy, this may have to do specifically with Buddhists, whereas the Two Truths and so forth, and also the functioning of the mind as to when we say that the mind engages with its object through the principle of elimination or through the principle of demonstration and so forth, there cannot only be confined to Buddhist study, but they are shared with others, and therefore we can talk about, we can refer to them as academic subjects. So with regard to logic and psychology, we can refer to them as ancient Indian psychology and logic, and they become in this way more of an academic subject. So in India, there are many different religious traditions, homegrown religions, as well as immigrated religions, such as Christianity, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, and so when we talk, if we talk about philosophy, generally, I mean, this can actually cover all the different traditions as well, the whole humanity. So in Ladakh, at my behest, on my behest, they have started teaching logic to the students in schools. And one time there was a demonstration of debate, a presentation of debate in front of me. And amongst those school children who were debating, there were Muslims students as well. And so logic is something that we as humans share, and we need this. So we as Tibetans, gradually, it seems that we are getting more opportunity to serve the world through our own tradition of logic and philosophy. So I started this this venture in the world, but now you, the younger generation, have to keep up with it and continue this legacy. So I have been talking to people that we have this great tradition all the time, and now you, the younger generation, and then the students in the monastic institutions also do this, keeping up with the tradition. So I am already an old man. I may not live very long, so as I am in my 80s, although I have the determination to do a lot of things, but I feel tired more easily these days because of the physical exhaustion, and so this is a fact. So I have led my horses, telling people that we have such a great tradition. And having done that, having said that, there must be the horses who actually can show to the people what I have been saying or telling them is actually true. And so you need to continue this after my generation. So I'm like the setting sun, and this tradition that we have, the Buddhist, ancient Indian Buddhist tradition, and also the other sciences like medicine and so forth, that we brought from India. We're not talking about preserving it for just one generation or one nation of people. And you need to actually keep up with this preservation for generations on. So I was joking with some people, joking with them, saying they have actually made a minute-by-minute program. So at 9 o'clock, they said, they had written that the introduction to Buddhism will be started. At 10, there will be question and answer sessions, and then at 12 is lunchtime. So as I said before, once I open my mouth, I keep on talking, blah, blah, blah. So this program actually is telling me I should keep silent. But I wish to say a few words. Of course, we'll have two more days. So the texts that we have chosen, that I have chosen, are these two. The Commentary to Awakening Mind by Nagarjuna and the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. So the first text is related to Tantra, yet Master Nagarjuna has wrote this text as a philosophical text dealing with the philosophical assertions of non-Buddhist traditions and then the other Buddhist traditions. So usually I say that all religions have three aspects. One is religion. So with regard to religion, it is a shared principle, which is the love, compassion, and love, compassion, tolerance or patience, and then contentment and self-discipline are principles which are shared in all the religious traditions. So all religions teach these. So all religions teach love and compassion. So on the basis of this, it is possible to have harmony amongst the religions of the world. We will not only be left with mere words. So on the basis of this, we can respect all religious traditions of the world because they all teach love and compassion. And then the second aspect is philosophical conceptions or ideas in which there are differences. Mainly, there are those of the religious traditions which believe in a creator God and those which reject creator God. So in India, for maybe the last over 3,000 years or so, there was the Sankhya school of philosophy started, And so Sankhya School was the original school of philosophy in India, from which derived the other non-Buddhist traditions. And then there was the Jain tradition. So Jainism doesn't believe in a creator God. Is it very clearly mentioned in Jamyang Shepa's great treatise on the philosophical systems of India? Is it clearly mentioned whether Jainism believes in a creator God or not? Anyone? So I have been inquiring my Jain friends whether they actually accept, and other people here also do not remember whether Jamyang Shepa's great treatise on the philosophical systems of India mentions whether Jainism believes in a creator God or not. So it's not only me. I'm not alone here. And I have had discussions with Jain practitioners, and asked this, and it seems they do not believe in a creator God, but they do believe in karma. But while believing in karma, they also say that when someone dies, they do talk about a person who goes from this life to the next, and a conscious person, as it's called, and as it's mentioned in the Sankhya school. So, even those traditions which reject any creator God, I mean, apart from Buddhism, there are those who, I mean, they still assert the some kind of entity called self or Atman. So the reason why they say this is because there is past and future lives. We go from one life to the next, and therefore there must be something which goes from one life to the next, apart from the mind and the body. Whereas in Buddhism, it is said that in Buddhism, there is rejection or for self apart from the body and the mind combination, and the designation of a person on the basis of them. So Jainism seems to be not accepting creator God. So after Jainism, Mahavira, then, 30 or 40 years later, Buddha Shakyamuni appeared in the world. And Buddha, of course, has not explicitly said that there is no creator God as such, but when he taught the Four Noble Truths, he actually taught about the suffering and its cause, which is the origin, and then with regard to the results that we achieve as through the practice of the path, the teaching, we attain true cessation, which is led to by the true path. And so, from this, we do understand the Buddha bases his teaching on the working of the law of causality. And so, philosophically, there are those religious traditions which reject any independent self or Atman or soul, and then those which accept And so those who reject this as such a self are three, non-theistic Sankhya school, Jainism and Buddhism, where the rest of the religious traditions assert some form of self. So just because we have philosophically we have different views doesn't is not a reason for us to fight with each other. Because even with amongst the followers of the one teacher, the same teacher, Buddha, there are different assertions of different philosophical people who assert different philosophical assertions, such as these Vaibhashikas, Sautantikas, and Chittamatras and Madhyamakas. And even within each school, there are the subdivisions. So the Buddha himself sometimes seems to, when he stated that the five psychophysical aggregates are the loads, and the carrier of this load is a person, and so it is as if indicating there is a separate self who carries the load of the five psychophysical aggregates. And then there is also the teaching where the Buddha states that the objects which are perceived by the minds have some form of a true existence, some kind of a degree of true existence. And so there is no fighting amongst the Madhyamakas and Chittamatras, saying that, oh, you are a follower of Chittamatra, go away. But Bhava Viveka seems to be quite aggressive towards Asanga and Vasubandhu. In his writing, he says that they are shameless to reject, to actually assert some philosophical assertions, come up with some philosophical assertions which are contrary to what Master Nagarjuna has said. Master Nagarjuna, who was prophesied by the Buddha himself to be a chariot drawer or a train blazer. And so we cannot push them out and of the Buddhist tradition by saying, oh, you are Vaibhashikas or Tantrikas and so forth. And so similarly, just as we do not push the other schools of philosophy within Buddhism as Madhyamaka followers, we should also see that all the religious traditions of the world are for the to help people to become good human beings, and because they teach love, compassion, all religious traditions, and therefore there's every reason for us to respect them and actually befriend the followers of other traditions as well. So, for example, in the case of Muslims, they say that some of my friends say that all if you are following the Islam, you should respect all creature of Allah. And so should actually embrace everyone in love and compassion. And similarly, it is the case with Christianity, and who say that this very life was created by God, and therefore, when you think along these lines, you feel really close to the God, the Creator, and the God, the Creator, is seen as someone who is infinite love, and so such an infinite love it has created me. When you think about this, then you will actually emulate the practice of love and compassion. And so all traditions are for the spread of love and compassion, and therefore we need to, despite the philosophical differences, we need to respect all the religious traditions because of the practice, the common practice of love and compassion. And then when these religious traditions spread in the world, the society was more or less in a feudal system, following a feudal system. And then those who actually are supposed to be the custodians of the teaching. And for example, in Tibet, there we actually came up with the system of tulkus, reincarnations of lamas. And so under the feudal, under the influence of the feudal system, we have the tulku system, and then these lamas also became the leaders of the people while also being the teachers of religion. And then, for example, with regard to the Dalai Lamas, the first Dalai Lama, Gendun Trobe and Gendun Gyatso and so forth, were not political leaders, but from the fifth Dalai Lama on, the Dalai Lama became the political, temporal leader of the Tibetan nation. And then in 2011, I actually devolved this my political authority very proudly and happily, and voluntarily I actually left the political authority because the system that we were following was put in place under a feudal system. So we need to make modifications in according to the reality of today's world. So we cannot say, for example, in India, that we are, we need to make modifications in the different traditions. So I've always been telling the Indians to make change in the caste system as well, because in the teaching of the Buddha, it is said by the Buddha, whatever family lineage you are born into is not important, but the important thing is one's practice of the teaching. So when I was in China in 1954-55, Mao Zedong has told me that the Buddha was a revolutionary because he actually was opposed to the caste system in India. Sometimes Mao Zedong also praised even Tara, saying that Arya Tara, the Lady Tara, is someone who actually fights for women's rights. But at one point, Mao Zedong also told me that the religion is opium or poison. So the caste system is some kind of a cultural customs that has passed down in India. And then when the religions of the Middle East evolved, those regions were more or less nomadic regions, and there was not much rule of law. And so, in Quran, for example, we find the Sharia law. So this was put in place in accordance with the societal setup or the So as the world changes, sometimes I think we need to rethink the Sharia law. But the main practice of teaching of the Quran is love and compassion. Today we use the term Islamic or Muslim terrorists and so forth. So take your tea, we don't need to say the blessing. So actually the students have already finished their tea, it seems. So that's, you have done the right thing. We have this practice whereby the practitioners actually imagine and visualize themselves as a deity and then offer the tea and meals to the deity. So I usually emphasize all the religious traditions sharing and the message of love and compassion. Whereas when it comes to philosophy, there are differences, of course. So with regard to philosophy, we have a tradition with which we can actually have discussions with scientists. So even atheists who actually criticize religion, so because we use reasoning, I mean, we can actually shut up the people who criticize our religion. If you only base yourself on the on faith alone, then we cannot do that. So the unique philosophical concept and the tradition that we have must be studied by you, because if you study this, the interdependent nature of things, then you also become more broad-minded and more open, and then you will be less depressed, and it'll help you physical health-wise, and you'll be more happier as well. And so, to introduce Buddhism, I have chosen Nagarjuna's commentary on the awakening mind. And then when it comes to putting the teaching into practice, I have chosen the 37 practices of bodhisattvas. So from 10:30, it says in the program that we'll have a question and answer session. So if you have questions, people, please come forward inside.
My question is, we Buddhists, why is taking refuge is very important? Why does we Sambhadrabhache has said in one of his teachings that taking refuge is very important foundation. So what is the, can you explain on this? So he only says taking refuge can be differentiated into two things, on the basis of view and on the basis of conduct. Based on the four seals of Mahayana. So those who accept these four seals, they become Buddhists on the basis of view. Whereas if one accept the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, as the object of refuge, so they become Buddhist. So one become Buddhist in two different ways. Now there's a distinction here. In the Vaibhashik school, there's a distinction made. It is explained there that those who this school doesn't accept the last seal, which says all phenomena are empty of inherent nature or the inherent self. This is not accepted in their school. So according to their school, now the Buddha is the teacher refuge, object of refuge, and the ultimate real object of the refuge is the Dharma, and the Sangha is the assistant. So the real object of refuge is the cessation of delusion, afflictive emotions, and the parts that one generates, awakens within one's continuum. That is the real object of refuge. So the real object of refuge is not out there, but rather inside, within our own continuum. So when these qualities of cessations and awakenings develop within our continuum, we can protect ourselves. Therefore, in the 400 verses, when a Buddhist says, I take refuge in the Dharma, that is the ultimate, the real object of refuge. So this refers to the cessation of afflictive emotions and the parts, the antidote of afflictive emotions. So through this understanding, we can understand that the Buddha, the teacher who taught the cessation of the afflictive emotions and the paths, that is the real teacher. So if we go into refuge in the three jewels through this kind of understanding, our refuge practice becomes a strong practice. Otherwise, if we just do recitation of the refuge prayers, it has just become like a mere recitation without much meaning. We must try to be practitioners, followers of the Buddha, on the basis of logic and reasoning, not on the basis of faith. If we go on the rely on the basis of faith, then there's no need for the 200 to 300 volumes of Buddha's teachings, sutras, and the commentaries. So we have a huge number of volumes of texts, scriptures written by great masters, theses and treatises. These are for studying, not for just faith. So the Dharma is really accords with science, modern science, and it's accords with reasoning and logic, and with scientific study. So if we can develop a good faith on the basis of reasoning and logic, then our faith is also will be a strong, solid faith, not just blind faith. So if we just always recite, for example, the refuge prayers without much understanding, it's difficult to say whether it's really becoming Buddha Dharma practice or not. In Lhasa, I used to have one friend. He's a Muslim. So when we meet and sometimes talk, he will say, he will swear. Sometimes when he is talking, he swears by saying, the three objects are refuge, like saying Allah, by God. But he doesn't really understand. So for the last, since 30 years ago, His Holiness has tried to connect, make a bridge between science and Buddhism. Einstein said if Buddhism and Buddhism is closest to science from monk Buddhism, based on the fact that Buddhism is based on logic and reasoning. So, according to Darwin's evolutionary theory, human nature is said to be aggressive. Darwin talks about the survival of the fittest, and that also that human nature is by nature aggressive. Whereas in Buddhism, human mind is said to be of clear nature. So, what is the? How can we close the gap between these two different views? Just as His Honor says, just as he explained earlier, I have been having dialogue with scientists for the last 30 years. I don't talk about past life and future life. I don't talk about nirvana, liberation. I just merely talk about the mind, the science of the mind, and about small particles.
Quantum physics.
Like, for example, quantum physics. Once I went to a university in Calcutta, and there was one professor who is said to be a quantum physicist, and I immediately paid attention, and I said, I would like to meet you separately. And we had quite an in-depth discussion with him. And after that, I told him that we should have a sort of a special dialogue between quantum physicists and Buddhism. But this the meeting so far hadn't taken place. So in my dialogue with scientists, we don't really talk about like things like past life, future life, that sort of thing, and nirvana, that sort of, this is not so relevant. As regards what you said just now, science generally, but we must always keep in mind that the scientific viewpoint keeps on changing from time to time. At the beginning of the 20th century, scientists don't really talk about the science of mind. They just talk about the brain. When I had a meeting with Japanese scientists in Japan, and there was one neuroscientist, quite a reputed one. He said that there's no mind separate from the brain. That's his standpoint. And one of his son died. So despite his viewpoint, he was very worried about the fact that his son died. But he was under great depression due to that fact. So His Honor says that that's kind of funny, because if his mind, there's no mind separate from the brain, why doesn't he just sort of do with that brain so that his depression will go away? But as time passed, scientific viewpoint has changed, and today science is very keen on the nature of the mind, and so in the recent past, I had on several occasions with meetings with scientists. They are saying that the human beings' natural aptitude is compassionate. They are not saying it's aggressive. You have heard that it is aggressive. Maybe this is a past, bygone view. Uh, So maybe that is related to a past view, because in the past, scientists believed that in early times, human beings were a little bit aggressive because human beings needs a lot of strength in surviving. And then in my recent discussions with scientists, scientists showed me a picture of a child. He's just very small, couldn't even really talk well. And they showed cartoons of two children were tested. Two children were shown climbing up a mountain or something like a hill. And one is helping the other child by pushing up and playing together and then going up, trying to climb up. In a very friendly and harmonious and playful manner. When this picture was shown, the child who's about 5 to 6 months old became very cheerful and playful and happy. Then the same child, another picture was shown, two children trying to climb up a hill, and one is trying to push up the other child. And then another child was shown trying to push that child, those two child down by trying to bully them. Then this child, this 5 to 6 month old child, was showing a sign of displeasure, unhappiness, and a slight disturbed mind. So they're saying that the very nature of the human body is such that when there's strong burst of anger, jealousy like that, the immune system itself within our body is harmed and is compromised. Whereas when there's peace of mind and calm and tranquility, the immune system get boosted. So the peace of mind, they are saying, calm and peace of mind, they are suggesting, is rooted in the mind of compassion. And a number of those scientists that I have met, not just one, two, many, they are in big gatherings, scientific meetings. They're all saying it's sort of very much rooted in compassion. So I felt greatly reassured and confident that if compassion is the foundation of human happiness, the current state of the education system in the world is such that it is based on materialistic education, including in India. For example, in India, it was introduced by the British, and the British system was very much influenced by the Industrial Revolution time. Even before that, it was influenced by the church, the education system in the church. So as technology and industry developed, especially also medical science developed, the education system in the church was considered as not adequate, and then a separate educational system was established based on materialistic values. So in this values materialistic educational system, the moral values, the education of values was ignored and sort of more or less deleted. And materialistic approach was considered as the most focus, main focus. So, for example, in the Western system, the moral values, the responsive in inculcating moral values was sort of put upon the church, whereas, and the modern education was The responsibility of the imparting moral education was taken by these model educational institutions, which hugely based their education on materialistic value. So as time passed, when this hugely materialistic educational system completely took over, and since that education system completely ignored the mental part of the mental part of the human happiness, so that's why a lot of problems arise. Now, who are these people who created a lot of problems in the world? These are all highly accomplished educationally, intellectually, but because they lack in, they don't know, understand, they don't lack understanding on the happiness, or the importance of peace of mind, and the value of compassion and love like that. So that's what happened. For example, in another incident, about 10,000 people. There's a gathering, 10,000 people. There's one man who it's a gathering on stopping the proliferation of nuclear weapons. He told me that when a child is born, for a few weeks, for the child, it is if the mother keep the child near to her body and sort of in physical contact, it greatly plays an important role in developing the brain of the child. On the other hand, he's saying that if the child is put somewhere separate from the mother, give milk like that without much physical contact, this will greatly harm the baby. So if the child has received physical touch and direct touch and love from the parents, mother especially, it will greatly help the child in as he grew up in becoming a more calm, matured, and peace with himself kind of person. On the other hand, if this was deprived, the child throughout his life, the child as he grew up, will have some kind of a deep down in a sense of abandonment, and like an abandoned child. So these are not about religious talk. These are like real practical sort of findings. This is not about future life and past life. This is about problems we are facing, issues relating to happiness in this life, the importance. So even like kittens and dogs, puppies, they're all birds. They all need this mother's love and compassion. It's important for all because if there's a sort of a certain amount of nurturing through love, the child grows up into sort of a very confident and peace with himself kind of person. So as far as what I heard, the basic human nature is loving and compassionate. Now you are saying it's aggressive. So we don't really know who has the truth. We will have to find it out that later on.
Yes. So my question is that in this universe, I see these plants, trees, mountains, river, ocean. Oh. Everything is serving to this universe in certain way. And to the human being also.
What is that?
The question is, there are plants, animals, many things in this world. Everything is trying to survive.
On this universe, like, how are we serving to this universe? Or, I mean, apart from, we can focus on controlling our mind and being more conscious and aware, and we reproduce. But I'm not sure if that serves to anyone else apart from our own self. So what is our purpose? I don't know, there may not be any purpose, but if you, sort of, what is your thinking about this?
Everything in this world trying to survive, plants, animals.
I do that question.
What is the role of human, what is the purpose of human beings? Because human beings...
So this, naturally, is some connection, the concept of creator.
Like that.
So, according to those tradition, you see, no concept of creator, then the planet itself, you see, I think something like our mother. We, including human being, all sort of sentient being on this planet, I think happen because of a certain condition. So the planet, rivers, airs, vegetables, these eventually produce us.
In translating to Tibetan?
Not we created these things.
You ordered me to do so.
I think according to Buddhist tradition, Buddhist concept, Darwin theory, firstly some kind of jellyfish, then gradually a different form of physical condition come. And some other Buddhist literature is mentioned something differently, but I believe the more the Darwin theory, that's more, I think, realistic. Like that. Some, I think, a small group, pockets, some people, may have some sort of different. In Tibet, there are cases. Conceptual way. Nya chayat. Nya chayat. Chokpo chayat.
Conceive.
Or conception. Conception. Through certain dreams is quite mysterious. When I was young, Lhasa, there are some sort of people we usually call Lhotu.
Child of God.
Some strange dream come, then eventually conceptual ray, conceived. So then that child, unusually, you see, strong. So it actually, you see, such things happen. So therefore, our traditional sort of, I say, the saying or belief, the Tibetan origin in some area in southern Tibet. You see, so I feel that also may be true, but that we cannot say entire Tibetan population come that way. I do not think. So Tibetan sort of population, I think it is quite interesting. I think we have to sort of carry some research work. Recently, some Chinese, you see, carry some research that Tibetan, some kind of a human race, human civilization, or you see, 30,000 years. So these things, which is scientific sort of, because of the research of scientific research, scientific finding. So it is important, gradually. So in any way, I believe Darwinian theory, evolution, like that. Then why this world come? Then please you ask God. I don't know. Then if you, of course, I respect, as I mentioned earlier, all major religious tradition. Many of them believe creator. Wonderful. It helped. So wonderful. But from the Buddhist viewpoint, there is some contradiction. One occasion, one Indian, very, very good my friend, wonderful, very religious minded, very seriously religious minded. One day he asked me a difficult question. Since whole world created by God, and God enlightened, and also, you see, very powerful. So then his question is, why humanity, which created by God, the loving kindness, infinite love, so among his creation, there are many, I said, the mischievous people, bad people, there. Why God created that? He asked me this question. And I find it difficult to answer. So I just mentioned, well, since God also created hell, so there must be someone who go to hell. Otherwise, you see, no meaning, creation of hell. So in any way, is a person who believe God, wonderful. Then as a student of Buddhism in general, particularly Nalanda tradition, then there are so a lot of discussions in these great Indian sort of masters sort of text. So then it is quite difficult, you see, believe, or uncomfortable, you see, believe creator. Okay. Next question. This is the last question now.
So, this is asked by someone else, actually. So what makes you happy every day in the middle of all this madness? How do you keep your sanity on a daily basis?
My selfish reason. It is much better remain happy or relax. Now here, one, I think, the as a Buddhist student, you see, teaching mainly, you see, 2 points. One, try to reduce at the kasa, selfish, self-centered attitude. For that, try to increase altruism. That's very, very powerful. You see, I daily my practice, thinking, analyze these things. So I feel, now, entire sentient being, usually we call mother sentient being. So most of the kasuta develop about that sort of concept. And then I feel entire sentient being is my dearest friend. So there are some people who criticize me, who sort of showing a negative attitude, that's not as a sentient, not because of sentient being, but because of their sort of destructive emotion. But being itself, wonderful. So that, thinking that line, then the entire sentient being, particularly 7 billion human beings in this, on this planet, I feel very dear. I always consider entire 7 billion human beings my brothers, sisters. It's very, very helpful, very powerful. Then the paranjasa sight, wisdom sight, we analyze things what is the ultimate reality. Now, true truth, concept of true truth, appearance and reality. As far as now, all our destructive emotion entirely based on appearances. Again, one my sort of friend, one scientist, his name, Aaron Beck, an American, very old. Now, I don't know whether he alive or not. My first meeting, then his age already 84 years old. Then my last meeting, he already 97, like that. Now I don't know. He told me, he's not religious-minded people. See, he, sort of his sort of today, profession is helping people, you see, who much disturb their mind due to anger. So last several decades, you see, he deal such people. So he make conclusion. When people develop anger, the object which that person feel angry appears very negative. But actually, 90% of that negativeness is mental projection. This is exactly Nagarjuna stated. One Tibetan word, the Nagarjuna in Zao Shiranaliya, Leta Nyomu Seve Tham, Leta Nyomu Namdole.
Nagarjuna
has said in his Let the new nonetheless say
that
the second sunshine of the Mindu Kajakajetu.
At the end of the secession,
they are
caused by
Namdol.
In other words,
is
a misconception of the object. And then when that occurs, the mind makes fabrications on the basis of that misconception. And the fabrication either sees the object extremely good, positive, or extremely negative. So based on that, one develops either strong desire or strong repulsion, which is hatred. So this is exactly sort of similar with the findings of Aaron Beck, the scientist, the psychologist. So how does this misconception occur? It's based on the seeing the object as existing inherently. When this basis fundamental misconceptions there, the next misconceptions, the ensuing misconception occurs, which sees the object in a wrong way, which is an exaggeration, a fabricated mind, and this further leads to more fabrication. Which further leads to more fabrication. So through the practice of method, one practices altruism, and through the practice of wisdom, one develops the wisdom of emptiness, lack of inherent nature. So
your attitude towards anything more holistic, with wider perspective, wider perspective, because of perspective. So that is very helpful. There is no independent, absolute negative. Everything interconnected. Once you have that kind of perception, then the intensity of the hatred automatically reduce. So through these two practice, I can deal my destructive emotion. Now last a few decades, as a result of thinking, analytical meditation, the almost anger and attachment almost gone. So that brings peace of mind. Okay. Now last question. Just one last question.
First of all, I bow my head to His Holiness and all the monks. My question is, as we know, as the leader, so are the followers. So why not monks can become politician leaders and lead the nation to development as they have having all the capacity of becoming so?
Correct. That usually in India,
I'm sorry,
whole northern India,
suggesting or expressing
the monk or nuns in monastery or nunnery better to avoid the political activities, including election. So that is my usual sort of feeling. Because it's a politics, as people say, dirty politics. So I think, morally speaking, I think monks and nuns, I think, should not indulge in dirty politics, I feel. Eventually, politics become clean politics. And then, okay. Marbaya, and the chips is you do chishes and shaw shan di chips.
The current situation in political elections is that there's a lot of hatred between the different political parties, even within the monks' monastic community. The monks used to say to each other, he's a supporter of that party and I'm a supporter of this party. This is very, very, very disturbing. So, so this is not very good. And in our case, in our Tibetan society custom, we always make propitiation to the Dharma protectors. So if it is okay for us to take part in political elections, then why don't we also go to the Dharma protectors and say, please destroy the other party and support one another party like that. And so this is wrong. On the other hand, these Dharma protectors are sublime beings, actually, and so when we make prayers for all sentient beings, impartially. So this is sort of wrong for the monastic community to participate in. So in the daily life, in our worldly. So it's better for the monks to keep quiet and not even if one has sort of dislike for a certain party in one's mind, just keep quiet and think about that.
See you again tomorrow.